Hey folks, it's Mike from Profiling Evil. I've been studying criminal behavior for more than 40 years, and one of my favorite research tools is Truth Finder. It's online, and you're not going to believe the information stored there. So if you want to know more about that new neighbor, your babysitter, or your online date, give Truth Finder a try. I'm including a special link below with special discount pricing, but you got to click the link and enter EVIL10 at checkout. Now, we're an affiliate, which means we get a small commission, but you can cancel at any time. Hey, everybody. Welcome to Profiling Evil Podcast. In this special episode about 21-year-old William Brian McKenzie. He disappeared on September 27th, 2019, mysteriously in Jackson, Tennessee. It would take nearly 2 years to find his 2006 Jeep Liberty, submerged in a pond only a few miles from his home. How did it end up on this private cul-de-sac street with only one way in and one way out? Well, we're going to be examining the timeline leading up to his disappearance and talking with the man who located his vehicle. Is this a missing persons case, an accident, or is this murder? Well, on Sunday, August 29th, 2021, 702 agonizing days following his disappearance, Jackson, Tennessee police confirmed the discovery of William Brian McKenzie's vehicle. They discovered human remains inside the vehicle, which have now been turned over to a Tennessee medical examiner. While they work on identifying the remains found in McKenzie's car, his mother, Frances Gaines, waits. Her text to me the following morning was heartbreaking as she inquired, quote, "How long does it take? My heart wants to explode," close quote. Well, folks, take a moment, hit the like and the subscribe button and ring the bell if you'd like to receive notifications on videos like this one. Thanks for supporting us at Profiling Evil. And by the way, have you considered our channel memberships? You can get a little more insight and a monthly opportunity to chat privately with the Profiling Evil team. Please check out our options. September 27th, 2019 started like any other day as Brian McKenzie left his mother's home for the 10-minute drive to work at Denny's restaurant. The kid worked hard every single day, and his coworkers often mentioned how he took great pride in his work. As the shift came to a close around 3 in the afternoon, Brian punched out, said goodbye to his mother, who also worked at Denny's, and bolted out the door to meet some friends. Brian had gotten his driver's license only 2 weeks earlier, and he was so excited about the independence that he was feeling. It was payday, and Brian exited Denny's, grabbed some fuel at the gas station next door, and pulled into a vacant lot across the street to send a couple of text messages and to answer a phone call. The caller asked Brian to come to his home, just a short 3-minute drive to the north. Let's listen as Brian McKenzie's mother, Frances, retraces his steps on that day.
I was recruited from IHOP, and so I joined the Denny's world, and then I had recruited my son. He didn't want to leave IHOP. He wanted to stay there, and I said, come on, I want you to come and work with me. My son started working there at Denny's, and he was there for a short time, less than a month. And he actually didn't even have his driver's license then. He was going through trying to get his driver's license. So a couple of weeks prior to him being missing, he got his driver's license. So he was very excited about it, started letting him use my Jeep to go back and forth.
My son clocked out at 3 p.m. in the afternoon, and from what I was, what I seen on footage is he clocked out and he left, but then he had pumped some gas and he drove across the road to the other side to next gas station, Speedway Cross, and got a phone call, I guess, from footage of his car going into the next gas station across the street. It only took like a minute and he drove right back out the way he drove in. And guess he got a text or phone call, and from his phone log and from my understanding, he got that call from the person who wanted him to come over to his house.
The friend was a coworker named Sean, who later told Francis that another 21-year-old associate named Keenan Murphy was also at the residence when Brian arrived. According to Francis, the kids hung out and may have smoked some marijuana. Well, eventually, while they're there, Murphy asked Brian for a ride, and the two left the residence alone. That was the last time Sean reportedly saw Brian McKenzie. Let's listen as Francis describes what happened.
They hung out on the porch, and they do what boys do. They do their stuff, hang out, do boy stuff. I guess my son had asked if he had marijuana, and the boy said yes, he wanted him to come over, and he would give him some. So my son went over there, and I guess he smoked with him, and then they were hanging out on the porch for a while. I did have a problem with it a lot of times with any of that, you know, marijuana, everything. I don't even like taking Tylenol. That day my son hung out, I guess that person had asked, the other person asked a ride home. He went to Sean's house. Keenan Murphy was on the porch. Keenan Murphy asked for a ride. Keenan Murphy got that ride, and my son disappeared from there.
Well, it would later be discovered that Keenan Murphy also allegedly shot four men in two separate incidents before and after his time in place with Brian McKenzie. Two of those men died from their gunshot wounds. Just 2 days before Murphy convinced Brian to give him a ride, the alleged killer shot Joe Ramirez and Julio Almaraz. In a signed statement that would be read aloud in court, Murphy said that he decided to shoot the men while they were giving him a ride. He said the reason was because they said something that made him angry. According to reports, Murphy met Ramirez through Facebook when Ramirez was trying to sell a Glock 27, a 40 caliber handgun. They met where Murphy lived at the Scottish Inn. Murphy's statement went on to say that he shot Ramirez, and since he didn't want to leave a witness, he had to shoot Almaraz. Murphy was in the back of the car when the vehicle stopped in front of an abandoned house, and he allegedly shot both of them in the back of the head. That victim vehicle and the two victims were found by police. The car was on a fire. It was crashed near Neff Circle and Middleton Street, just 15 minutes south of the Scottish Inn. Well, 2 days later, Murphy and Brian McKenzie leave Sean's residence. They drive to Dollar Tree. Francis received a troubling call from Brian while they were there. He told her that he was heading home soon, and he repeatedly told his mother that he loved her. My question is, did he sense that he was in danger? I found it interesting that their travels took them to the Scottish Inn, Murphy's residence, and ultimately to the last place Brian was known to be, Knight's Inn, which is just north and really less than 4 minutes from Brian's home. Listen as Frances describes the last phone call she had with her son at 5:32 p.m., just outside the Dollar Tree where he was standing.
It's hard. I'm trying to go back in time and to remember what was going on. And I spoke to my son on the 27th, and he was telling me everything was going to be okay. But he was telling me, like, Mom, it's going to be all right. Don't worry. I was like, what's going to be all right? Why are you telling me this? I know it's going to be okay. I need you to come home. He goes, yes, Mom, I'm on my way home. I'll be home. I want to tell you I love you. I said, I love you too. And I said, why are you... What's wrong, Brian? And he said, nothing. I just want to tell you I love you. And I'm going to be home. I said, where are you? He said, I'm not that far from home. I'm going to be home. Okay, just calm down, relax. Everything is going to be all right. I said, okay, but I really need you to come home already, okay? Because I know you're out of work already. You should be home already. He said, yes, Mom, I'm going to be home. Don't worry. I love you. He said, I love you a couple of times. And didn't come home. According to his phone records, his phone shut off seconds. And that was at 5:32. That was the last time I spoke to my son. And that was on the 27th. And he was telling me it was weird because he was telling me, Mom, it's going to be okay. It's going to be okay. And I was like, I know it's going to be okay. Are you on your way home? Because I need you to come home.
When Brian didn't show up for work the following morning, Frances was terrified. Let's listen as she describes how this nightmare and the reality of Brian's disappearance unfolded. I want you to think closely as you listen, too. I found some of Sean's behavior to be very troubling, and I am compelled to think that he knows much more about Brian's disappearance than he's sharing. At one point, as they're returning to Francis's home while they're searching together, Sean turns east. Francis says, "Why are you turning east? I live to the west." And Sean replied, quote, "I'm taking you places he could have went to take a shortcut to your house," close quote. This stood out to me because it's suspiciously close to the location where Brian's car was eventually discovered. Listen closely as Frances describes driving around with Sean as they searched for her son, Brian.
My son did not show back up for work the next day. I was wondering why he didn't show up. The next morning, I woke up, I walked around the front of the house, and I didn't see the Jeep in the driveway. And so I said, why isn't the Jeep in the driveway? I opened up the bedroom door, and I looked inside of his room, and I seen all the stuff wasn't touched. I saw his man bag was sitting on his bed along with his shoes. He's so organized. You can tell what's used, what's not. You know, I didn't see his uniform anywhere. I see his charger on the bed. His bed was not slept in. Jeep's gone. So I got to work, and the first one I spoke to was the boy, Sean, that he's my third shift server. I said, Sean, you were with my son yesterday. Where's my son? You know, I said, I heard you were with my son yesterday. Where's my son? And I said, the server told me that you were with my son. And he's like, yeah, he was at my house. He hung out for a while. I said, okay, Sean, he didn't come home last night. I don't know what's going on. I feel like something is wrong. My son didn't show back up home. And his first words were, oh, he probably went out and he got, you know, so he's a boy. Probably went out, got some booty. He did. Went out and partied, whatever. I said, no, that's not my son. My son doesn't go out and have booty. My son has a girlfriend, and he's very faithful to her, and that's not my son's way, and he's never late to work. He comes straight back home from work, and he was scheduled that day at 8 o'clock. So when 8 o'clock came around, and he didn't show up for work, I knew something was wrong. He said, do me a favor, just, you know, don't call the police, don't do anything, just wait for me, try to get a manager to watch your shift, and then I'll go out searching with you. And I said, where is he, Sean? He didn't come home last night, and he was with you. Everybody's saying that he was with you. And he said, he went home. I already know, I know he went home. He was complaining about anxieties, something about his heart was bothering him, and he was having anxieties, something about his medication, and he wanted to go home. I said, was he by himself? He said, yes, he's by himself. We were hanging out on my porch all by ourselves. Nobody else was there. I said, are you sure? He swore up and down, yes, yes, calm down, calm down. He called me Mama, you know, because that's the way I had my employees. They called me Mom because I was always strict at work, Mother. But I didn't want to tell Sean that I had already, you know, made that police report, because I had a feeling that if I told him that I had made that police report, he's not going to help me, you know, with my son, find my son, because I knew he knew where my son was. And then I had went to Sean's house, and he took me driving around. I noticed he kept looking down into the creeks, down on the side of the Jeep. I go, why are side of the inside of my car? I told him, why are you looking down at everything? Well, you know, we're searching. What are you thinking? He said, nothing. I'm just looking for tire marks or something. Maybe the car would go off. I said, well, we would see a car if we're driving, and it would be right here on the side of the road. He was looking down into like the creeks. So when I was in my car, I thought it was smart to just keep asking some questions, you know, about the day, of what, you know, what they were doing. Who was at the house? Still, nobody was at the house. It was just him and him. They were smoking. And Ryan had left. I said, which way did he go? He said that he went home. And I said, but why are we turning right? We live left. He said, look, just I'm taking you places that I know of that maybe he could have went a shortcut. This is a different way to your house. Okay. So as we're driving, I'm asking him questions about my son. And, you know, did he know that if he had any plans, that he did he have, was drunk? Was he high? Was he, you know, everything. Started telling me that, what do you know about my son? You don't want to be in trouble for something because you want to tell me something because you have a warrant. My son is missing right now. You need to tell me what's going on. He goes, I'm telling you everything that I know. He was at the house. We chilled on my porch. We smoked a little bit. I said, what did you smoke? He's like one or two blunts, he said. I said, okay. And after that, he left. I said, how could you let him leave if he smoked that much? He was not capable. I mean, how can anybody smoke? Would you guys drink? And he said, no, he said he's fine. When the only thing that he was upset about was when he was backing out of the driveway and he got stuck onto something on my fence and he thought you were going to be mad because he did something to the Jeep.
Well, Francis was not able to locate Sean, and the days turned into months, and the months turned into years. As she frantically searched every Wednesday and Saturday, her days off. At times she was alone. On other days, she was joined by an army of supporters, including the father of one of Keenan Murphy's other victims, Thomas Curry. As you may recall, Murphy confessed to murder on the 25th of September on the south side of Jackson, Tennessee. 2 days later, he was the last person to be seen with Brian McKenzie as they left in McKenzie's vehicle. Exactly 1 week later, on Friday, October 4th, 2019, Murphy allegedly contacted Thomas Curry on Facebook, same way that he contacted his previous victim. And they agreed to meet at Knight's Inn, where he planned on selling Curry a Glock pistol. Was it the same pistol that was used to murder Ramirez and shoot Almaraz? Perhaps to be used on Brian? Well, Murphy and Curry reportedly smoked some marijuana, and at some point, Curry angered Murphy, who later stated, I decided I was going to shoot him. Well, Murphy had Curry drive him 7 minutes to the north to a secluded street near Fairway Boulevard and Winding Creek Drive. Murphy had his gun out already, and when Curry refused to go any further, Murphy shot him in the head. Now, there was another passenger in the car who was shot, but he was lucky enough to escape and survive. Day after day, Frances searched for her son. Listen to her passion as she continued the search for Brian. Following her comments, I also want to play a little news report by WBBJ News.
I didn't never have a tweet before. Now I have tweet, and I'm going on YouTube, and I'm just trying to share all the information that I can possibly share. I get threatened that I'll be gagged because if I mention names or if I tell what's not true and what's not believable and accuse people of this and accuse people of that, well, you know what? I'm not accusing anybody. This is what happened. My son left work. He was somewhere. He went to the dollar store. He called me. This is the vehicle he was in. And this person asked my son for a ride, and he shot and killed someone on September 25th, and he shot and killed someone again on October 4th, then arrested. 4.2-mile radius where he got back on his phone or internet or whatever he did. In 48 minutes from my son's phone being turned off, getting checked into another motel. In all reality, he didn't have 48 minutes with my son. He didn't get caught until October. So he had an entire week in that 48 minutes to do what he had to do with my son and with my Jeep that I lent my son. I gave my son when he got his license, you know? It's His best friend. He considered a friend and he trusted. And this one said this one wasn't with him, you know?
If you know something anonymously, and you know my son, because my son was good to all of you. Good, good kid. Very honest, very loving, very funny and smart. And he just, please bring him home. Please help me bring him home. Say something.
In tonight at 5:30 with a mother continuing to search for her son who has been missing since September. Thank you for joining us. I'm Terry Jelks. WBBJ 7 Eyewitness News reporter Stephanie Fernandez is live in the studio with more details on the search. Stephanie?
That's right, Terry. The Jackson Police Department says William Brian McKenzie went to a friend's house in Madison County after getting off at work at Denny's. And since that day, no one has heard or seen McKenzie since September 27th.
A mother is desperately trying to find her 21-year-old son who has been missing since September. William Brian McKenzie's mother, Frances Gaines, says she is desperate and will not stop until she gets answers on her son's disappearance.
We're searching endlessly for my son, and it's becoming overwhelming to just search once or twice a week. I wish I could search every single day.
One of the volunteers, Thomas Curry, who is assisting in the search for McKenzie, says he can relate to Gaines after his son, Thomas Curry Jr., was shot and killed on October 4th, 2019.
I'm here to bring some closure to Francis Gaines. And I have my closure. I buried my child. I think about my son every day, every day, every day. I can't stand even look at a shooting incident on TV.
Volunteers searched wooded areas around Campbell Street and other areas around Jackson in search for any clues that may lead to McKenzie's whereabouts.
There's so many missing people out there. There's so many things going on here in Jackson, Tennessee. I've tried touching bases with the mayor. I'm touching bases with TBI, FBI, even Tennessee EquiSearch, and everyone needs approval from the Jackson Police Department. This is not because I'm saying that the Jackson Police Department cannot do their job. It is simply an asking point. Just help. Help them. They're overwhelmed. I'm trying to get you help. I'm trying to get my son help. They would just open the doors to TBI or the FBI.
Volunteers ask if anyone has any information, please come forward.
We're going to be here until this is done. We're working incredibly hard. Even when we're not searching, several of us are working behind the scenes with mapping out locations on Google Earth, talking with investigators, meeting with community members that might have information.
Gaines holds a search party every Wednesday and Sunday in hopes of finding any clues that may lead to her son's whereabouts. Live in the studio, Stephanie Fernandez, WBBJ 7 Eyewitness News.
Anyone with information regarding McKenzie's whereabouts is asked to call the Jackson Police Department at 425-8400.
By January of 2020, Profiling Evil was contacted by Jared Lysak of Adventures with Purpose, joined by Sam Ginn of Sam the Adventure Man, to help them in locating Brian McKenzie. We jumped at the chance to help Francis, quite frankly, and we conducted multiple interviews. We had discussions with police and numerous discussions with Francis as we tried to piece the timeline together. We researched Brian's phone calls. We created link analysis charts of his conversations, and we mapped where Brian traveled in those final hours. We provided maps and points of interest for search teams, and we worked with volunteers who called to help Francis. Jared's team was also joined by Mike at Muddy Bottom Adventures, and they searched a number of ponds, streams, and lakes. In the end, we were unable to locate anything, but we promised Francis that we'd do our part in keeping Brian McKenzie's disappearance alive. Then, on August 29th, 2021, Francis's prayers began to be answered. Yeah, in a town of 67,000 people, Francis Gaines and Brian McKenzie had never met Aaron Ingalls, but he would play an important part in their lives. They only lived 2 miles apart from each other. Aaron was at home taking care of a sick child and was lucky enough to have his father-in-law helping out. His father-in-law decided to take the little sick tyke out for a walk to see if it would brighten her mood, and they strolled outside the Ingalls' home and toward the northeast corner of the pond that sat next to the house. As they walked, Aaron's father-in-law noticed what he thought was a large piece of plywood approximately 3 feet below the water's surface. The object was about 70 feet from the pond's edge, and the water was so murky it made it difficult to figure out what it was. He told his son-in-law about it, and Aaron decided he would look at it in a day or two. Well, several days later, Aaron decided to take his little boat out into the pond and retrieve what he thought would be garbage. When he got in the general area, he noticed an odd shape in the water, but as he got closer, he yelled to his father that he thought it was a sunroof. With that, he paddled back to shore and called Jackson Police Department, who responded and then requested the West Tennessee Dive Rescue and Recovery Team to check it out. Let's listen as Aaron describes the discovery he made on August 29th, 2021. Hey, folks, I'm here with Aaron Ingalls. Aaron is the individual who found Brian McKenzie's vehicle out in Tennessee. And Aaron reached out to us and indicated that he had a couple of minutes to share what that experience was like. So, Aaron, welcome. Thanks so much for taking time to reach out to us and to talk about this.
Yeah, happy to help. It's been a wild week. It all started, I would say, last week. So my daughter got salmonella, which kind of kicked everything off. And my father-in-law was coming over to help babysit. And normally they walk on the street in a stroller. And because she wasn't feeling well, he decided that he was going to kind of just take her out and walk around the pond. And, you know, we've been here 5 or 6 years. And when we first moved in, we fished in the pond. We used it a lot, but, you know, it kind of wears off a little bit. So we see the pond a lot, but we don't go into it very much. And so he was walking around the pond and he said, "Hey, I think there's like a piece of plywood or a capsized boat out in the pond." Like you could see just the shadow of it. It was still real murky and you could only see just little vague bits. And also the homeowners association, the president had turned the pump of the pond off. So there's a well pump going into the pond and he turned it off like 3 months ago. So the water level has dropped like 2 or 3 feet from where it normally is, maybe more than that. It's way down real low right now. And so my parents came up, they were visiting in town and they stayed with us Saturday night. And then Sunday morning, my dad was out walking our dog and he was out by the pond. And I said, "Hey, our father-in-law, he said he saw something out there. Can you see if you can see it?" And so he's over on there's like a high bank on the side of the pond by the community boat dock. And so he's standing over there by the dock and you can only see it if you're up on that side. When you're on our side of the pond, you couldn't see anything. Like you could point it out and you couldn't really see much. But when you go over on that high side and you get an angle down, you could see a shadow down in the pond. And so we have a little paddle boat. And I said, "Can you point me to it? I'm going to take the paddle boat and try to get over there and see what it is." And at this time, I kind of thought it was like a capsized flat bottom boat. You know, you could see some, like it was long and it looked like it had some rails on it. So I get in the boat and I'm paddling out and I can't find it, but he's kind of guiding me over to it. And when I get right on top of it, I look down in the water and I put a pair of sunglasses on where I can kind of see down in there. And it looks like it's 3 feet under the water. I can't really tell. And I try to reach down and touch it, but I can't quite reach far enough in. Oh, I'm thinking it. Well, at first I thought it was like a flat bottom boat. I thought it was a capsized flat bottom boat just sitting in the water. And then all of a sudden I'm kind of looking, I'm kind of paddling around trying to get situated where I can see, because the glare, I mean, it was tough to see. I mean, even though the water level was down, it was still tough to see. And then I see, like, I thought it was a hatch. I thought there's some kind of hatch on it. So he thought it might have been some kind of controlled spillway where the hatch was to let the water out. And then the closer I looked, I said, "Dad, I think this is a sunroof. I think I'm looking down at a sunroof. I think this is a car in here." And I thought it was like a Suburban. It was, you know, it looked really big under the water. And I could start to see the roof rails. And then I kind of made my way to the back and I could see the hatches on the back hatch of the SUV. And so my first thought was, you know, this has been in here for 20 years or 30 years. It was, you know, when the pond was built, it was somebody dumped a car in here. I didn't even know about this case. Like, yeah, I had no idea about any of this. The first I heard about it was we come back out and I call the cops and I say, I think there's a vehicle in our pond. They come out and we're trying to point it out to them. Like I said, we get over on the bank and we're pointing out to the cops and it's still hard to see. They can kind of see the shadow and they're like, okay, see what we're going to do. We might call the dive team out and see what we got. And then they mentioned Jeep Liberty a couple of times. And so that was kind of weird. So I got a friend who's got a brother on the police force. And he says, yeah, there's a Jeep Liberty missing. And then he starts telling me about the case. So I go start looking it up and I'm like, wow, I wonder if that, you know, and still in my mind, I'm still thinking this thing's been in here for a long time because it looks so old when you finally got over it, it was so murky and it just looked like an old vehicle down in there.
As Aaron put two and two together, he was unsure it could be the same car, but he remembered seeing tracks leading into the water back in 2019. It was at a time when he was first learning how to fly his new drone. I want to mention that the drone imagery and videos are courtesy of Aaron Ingalls, who did a great job in recreating some of the walking paths and possible driving paths of Mackenzie's vehicle. So, Aaron, thanks for letting us use that. As law enforcement conferred with the dive team, it became apparent to them that the vehicle was the missing Jeep Liberty, driven by Brian Mackenzie. What Aaron didn't know at first was that the divers had also alerted police that human remains were inside the vehicle. Hey folks, I hope you are finding this video of the recovery of William Brian Mackenzie's vehicle valuable. There's a body inside, and we're waiting for the Tennessee medical examiner to rule whether it's Brian's body or not. All of the early indications would point to the fact that it is. Now, this has been an emotional roller coaster for Brian's mother and family. If you'd like to help them, please consider donating to their GoFundMe page. It'll help pay for Brian's funeral expenses and assist Frances as she continues to work with law enforcement in determining whether this is an accident or part of a murder investigation. Well, let's get back to the story. With divers in the water, Aaron and his family retreated to the property line and provided these photographs and videos. Then police alerted Aaron that it truly was Mackenzie's missing vehicle from September of 2019. Aaron remembered seeing tracks leading into the water about that same time, but closer examination of his video showed that they were actually tracks created before and after Brian's disappearance. So he wondered, is it possible that there are two vehicles in the water? Well, he alerted Tennessee divers who will return to check that out. But what I find interesting is that Murphy murdered people before and after Brian Mackenzie disappeared. Is it possible that there's a tie to this location? Listen as Aaron continues his description.
Call the police. They send the dive team out. They go down in there. And I remember the investigator, we kind of backed off at that point. We backed over to my property and we were just kind of watching from the side. The dive team goes down and they're on the vehicle looking at it. And the investigator comes back over because I had mentioned, I said, we found a shirt in the pond 2 months ago. As the water level was dropping, things on the bank started to we started being able to see stuff on the bank. And he came over and asking about the shirt. And I said, do you know what kind of vehicle it is? He says, yes, it's the one we're looking for. Yeah, it's getting bizarre. And so then I go to September 17th. I've got I think that was a photo that I sent you on the website. That's September 17th. There's tire tracks down beside the community boat dock going into the pond. So then I find one from October 5th. In October 5th, I've got a video where I flew the drone up and it was just kind of messing around with it. And you can see a shadow where the vehicle is. Like, so it was in there on October 5th, 2019. So I don't know. I mean, it's just speculation. I've sent all this stuff to the investigators, but it almost looks like whoever put him in there came in and there's another vehicle in there. Like, he did it once and then came back a month later and put that one in.
I then theorized with Aaron about the possibility of an accident or how the vehicle would purposely be put into the pond. We talked about someone driving into this closed neighborhood, which would require them, if they went into the pond, to make a hard left, drive across the island, down into the grass, and into the pond. Now, another option would be that the vehicle hit the dead end portion of the street, made a U-turn, and while driving out, made a hard right turn, ending up in the pond. And finally, another option would be that driving down the drainage area and directly into the pond could have been a way that that entered. Each is possible, and with the subsequent floating of the vehicle, the position it ended up in, frankly, remains a mystery. Well, listen as Aaron describes what was happening when police pulled the vehicle from the murky waters. I want to once again thank Aaron for the great photographs and video he took and for providing Profiling Evil with those. I'm glad he's a subscriber and that he reached out to us to share this amazing and, frankly, unnerving experience.
No, it was, when it came out, it was pretty murky and the windows were very dark. When they pulled it out, I was on the south side of the pond as it was coming out. They were on the north. They pulled it out just beside the boat dock, or just beside that little dock on the community side, but it was on the far side from my house. So they pulled it out in that corner of the pond. I was on the far other side of the pond, and I was looking, and yeah, they pulled it out on the northeast corner, and that's the same place where the tire tracks were going in. And so when they pulled it out, even the investigators and the recovery team, they were shining flashlights and trying to look in the windows. It was the windows were all so dark you couldn't see anything in. Yeah, it was pretty murky. I mean, like, we were on the far side of the pond, like I said. I went around after they got done, and I didn't notice anything.
Aaron Ingalls is the perfect example of someone who saw something and said something. He experienced what will hopefully be a once-in-a-lifetime event, but he represents each of us. You never know when you might find yourself in Aaron's shoes as a witness to a crime. So stay aware of your circumstances. Are there lessons that we can learn from this? I don't know. I mean, listen to Aaron's final thoughts on this case, and while you do, please join me in thanking him for reaching out to Profiling Evil and sharing his experience.
Yeah, it was tough. I mean, she was just like, the fact that it all happened while we were here, and we didn't even know it. It's just, you know, it's pretty bizarre. Yeah, I know. And then, you know, just the whole thing, just keep going back. I'm like, how did we miss it? When I saw the tire tracks, but you know, I guess if you're not looking for it and you're not thinking about it, like, it just, now it seems so obvious, but I mean, it was, you know, that's the thing that I keep going back to, is like, how did I not know? And it's pretty tough, but, I guess it's just what happened.
So after everything you've read about Brian McKenzie's story, what do you think happened to him and why? I'm going to be interested in your comments, and I hope that you'll take time to subscribe to Profiling Evil on your favorite podcast platform. And by the way, have you checked out our YouTube channel? You can find it by searching for Profiling Evil. And don't forget, visit our webpage at www.profilingevil.com. There you can sign up for our free BOLO, Be On The Lookout. It's our newsletter, and you can get additional content and offers for free items. Please hit the like and the subscribe button and ring that bell if you'd like to receive notifications on our videos. And folks, if you have any information on the William Brian McKenzie case, please contact the Jackson, Tennessee Police Department immediately. If you know something, folks, say something. We'll see you soon at the next crime scene. Hey folks, it's Mike from Profiling Evil. I've been studying criminal behavior for more than 40 years, and one of my favorite research tools is TruthFinder. It's online, and you're not going to believe the information stored there. So if you want to know more about that new neighbor, your babysitter, or your online date, give TruthFinder a try. I'm including a special link below with special discount pricing, but you got to click the link and enter EVIL10 at checkout. Now, we're an affiliate, which means we get a small commission, but you can cancel at any time.